Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 7:10:19. Hey, as always, we encourage you to be a part of the show. Write us email address kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, this is a special edition of the Financial Survival Network. Been promising you this for a while. We've got our good friend Mickey Fulp, aka Mercenary Geologist. You find him at mercenarygeologist.com. And the Twitter feed's at Mercenary Geo. With us, we're going to be talking about oil production in the United States, along with the fracking, along with prices, and whatever else comes into our minds. And Mickey, hey, we're finally doing it.
Well, we're finally doing it, Kerry. I had to postpone a month ago for my Stanley Cup binge, but I'm over that and still basking in the glory of that. But yeah, we're going to talk oil and gas today. I wrote a piece about a month ago now called America is the Big Bad Bully on the Black Gold Block. And we're going to kind of go through my points made in that mercenary musing.
All right. And hey, while you were busy celebrating, I think that the U.S. production went up 50 or 70,000 barrels per day.
Keeps going up. The April numbers, EIA, came in yesterday at 12.2 million barrels per day. We've seen estimates lately as high as 12.4, but that's 1.2 million barrel year-over-year increase, despite the fact that we've got something close to 90 less rigs drilling for shale oil at this juncture.
So what does that tell you when you see an increase in productivity there, production, and a decrease in the number of rigs?
Well, it tells you a better technology, more efficiency, and never counted a Texas oil man out.
Yeah, as long as there's a drop of oil in the ground, he's going to figure out how to get it.
Well, Kerry, realize that even in a conventional reservoir, you recover about 30% of the oil. And in these shale reservoirs right now, we extract about 10%. So there's lots of upside to the shale oil game from a technical viewpoint.
Yeah, and we've seen this so-called secondary recovery methods been in operation for decades now, but they keep improving. So all of these big oil reservoirs that were anticipated to run out decades ago, most of them are still producing. Very few big fields have been capped.
Well, I'll give you a couple of anecdotes. It's probably not a very well-known fact, but I started in the oil business. Had my first job at age 18 as a roustabout in oil fields. So I worked in Los Angeles in Inglewood, in the Inglewood Hills, right in downtown Los Angeles. And that oil field was thought to be on its last legs with secondary recovery, saltwater injection. And lo and behold, what is it now? 45 years later or so, still going strong. Shale is now the word there, and that oil field that was thought to be going way downhill is still producing oil today.
And it is amazing, because I go to LA fairly regularly, and you fly into the airport, and if you take the back way and you don't get on the 405, you take La Cienega, you see all of these wells that are pumping.
Kerry, I can tell you stories. I worked on Culver movie studios with a special pass to drive in a big service truck and service oil wells in little buildings covered up on the Culver City studios, and also in downtown LA, office buildings would have rigs in the lobbies. Little rooms that you go in and service these oil wells.
Yeah. When I first started going there about 35 years ago, those wells really did look like they were on their last leg. I mean, the pump was barely moving. Now, when you go there, those things are moving at a pretty brisk rate. So obviously something has happened and it's all about the shale, right?
Well, it's all about shale, but it's also all about American ingenuity and technology and engineering efficiency.
Mm-hmm. So we've seen this huge increase. I mean, while I was researching for our interview here, a few years back, the U.S. was pumping 8 million barrels a day, and they were saying, oh, we're getting close to the end here. You know, production can't go up much more than it is now. I mean, how can we do it? And yet, then the Permian Basin has gotten developed, and we're seeing more and more production, seemingly defying all of the expert predictions, which are always wrong. Experts are always wrong. That's the one thing. When you see a headline in it with experts say, you should automatically question it and assume that it's going to be wrong.
Well, since you brought up the numbers, let's go through some of them. Over the last 10 years, the U.S. has gone from less than 7% of world production to more than 13%. And in barrels per day since 2008, 5 million barrels a day to 12.2 million barrels per day in April. Net imports went from 67% in 2005 to 2018, 30%. Import to export ratios, 12.2 to 1.3. And it's not only shale oil. We're talking petroleum here, so we're going to talk a significant amount about shale gas, too. Two mm-hmm. times the production of natural gas since 2006. So, you know, this shale revolution really started in the gas business. And it's using old technology. So it started in the U.S. in 1981 with attempts to extract shale gas. But this is old technology. The first petroleum exploitation was in Fredonia, New York, upstate New York, in 1821. Mm-hmm. From the Marcellus Shale, which is the biggest shale gas producer in the U.S. Right now. They exploited shale gas and lighted village stores and streets with natural gas. We can go back even further. The Chinese, 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years ago, drilled with bamboo, which is hollow. They extracted shale gas and transported it through bamboo pipelines to boil brines to make salt over 2,000 years ago. Hydrofracking was first used in 1947, and horizontal wells were first drilled in California in the 1930s. Yeah. So this is not new technology in any way, shape, or form. It's just improved technology.
Yeah, that is a great point. So it's evolutionary. It's not revolutionary. And just when you're talking about Fredonia, New York, I actually know where that is. It's upstate. And yep. They were producing more natural gas back then than they are now because New York has a moratorium on fracking and on pipelines.
Well, yeah. So New York is one of about three states that have banned fracking and shale oil, shale ban, shale gas, shale oil. New York, Vermont, Maryland, get this, six counties in Northern California, and Boulder County, Colorado. The fractivists, which they have been called, I call them eco-fascists, have created the U.S.'s highest energy costs in New York and New England.
Forget it. It's insane. And when it gets really cold out during the winter, the price might be $2 on the spot or $4 if it's going in $5, but there could be $50 per million BTU.
Well, yeah, I've seen some crazy speculative prices over the winter. This past winter, I forgot what month it was. One It was a pretty mild winter in the Northeast Interior and Canada. But at some point, New England spot gas prices went up to $17.50 per million BTUs for a brief period of time. You know, it's just ridiculous, but it is what it is. Shale gas revolution, and I actually prefer to call it a revolution, started the Barnett Shale in Fort Worth, Texas, in the late 90s, or 1981. George Mitchell, Mitchell Drilling, started messing around with it. Took him until 1990s to figure out an economic method to extract it. That company was sold to a large independent oil and gas producer, Devon Energy, in 2002. So starting in the late 90s to 2005, by 2005, there were 16,000 wells exploiting the gas from the Barnett Shale in 25 counties in central Texas and produced more than 30% of Texas natural gas. I first heard about this revolution in April of 2007 in Albuquerque. I met with an old petroleum geologist, and he told me that the U.S. would be awash in natural gas in a few years. And of course, it was driven by very high gas prices from late 04 to late 2008, right when the global economic crisis hit. Natural gas averaged $8 per million BTU. It's about $2.40 today.
Yeah, that's crazy, and it's been trending lower. So we got to make the distinction between dry gas and wet gas, because most of you out there probably aren't familiar with it. But I think it's an important distinction. And technically, wet gas goes into the oil production numbers as well.
Well, your point's well taken, so let's kind of continue with the history and we'll segue into that. So by the mid-2000s, the oil men said, well, if we can do it for gas, why can't we do it for oil? And because natural gas, we're producing a lot of condensate and natural gas liquids. By the early 2010s, the Bakken was the place to be in North Dakota. Transformed North Dakota from a small oil and gas producer to the second largest state in the union, way behind Texas, but right now producing well over 1.3 million barrels per day. So we had the boom in the Bakken, and then the Texas oil millionaires came in, the wildcatters, or they're not quite wildcatters because these are development wells, but yeah. The speculators, they developed the Eagle Ford in South Texas, and now it's gone to the Permian Basin. So in about the last 5 years, 6 years perhaps, the Permian Basin, it has gone from not a lot of shale oil production. It is now the fourth largest oil producer in the world.
Yes.
In the world. Correct. So U.S. is number one, but then you've got the Russians and the Saudis in Iraq. And by the end of this year, the Permian Basin is going to exceed Iraq and become the third largest oil producer in the world.
Hey, and not to mention your home state of New Mexico is going to be producing shortly probably about 1 million barrels a day. And it was a minor bit player in the national petroleum production scene.
Yeah, point well taken there. We've always been, for as long as I can remember, the U.S.'s fifth largest oil producer, but way behind the other ones, California and Alaska. And now we're the third. And as of April, I think we produce 856,000 barrels per day. There's something on the order of 80 or 90 or 80 to 100, let's say, rigs drilling in the Permian Basin in southeast New Mexico right now. And certainly within a year or two, assuming prices hold, we should be up to 1 million barrels a day.
Yeah, so it's all miraculous, and it's in the face. I mean, I'm looking at an article here from March 9th of last year, and it says, experts say steel tariffs will stint U.S. oil production. At the time of this, they're saying because we have the tariff on steel that it's going to cut oil production because, you know, it's all based. It would all need steel pipelines, yep. Rigs, et cetera. And at that time, we were at around 10 million barrels per day. So it's a joke. Like, nobody can predict this stuff. Everybody's always surprised when it happens, except you and I, probably in a small minority of people who expect man to find solutions to what are seemingly insoluble problems.
Well, it's basically American oil men have turned petroleum source rocks into reservoir rocks. Shale is where the oil comes from, and it migrates into permeable reservoir rocks, sandstones and limestones. But we found a way to exploit that with fracking and horizontal drilling. The one thing, there's some caveats to this.
Sure.
So, shale oil is shallow and it's gas driven.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have the natural gas to drive it, you can't get it out of the ground. So what has resulted is every shale oil well is going to produce some natural gas. And we've ended up with this glut of natural gas in the United States, in the continental United States, in the heartland, and it's stranded. It's stranded for a lack of demand. It's the reason that prices over the last year have been averaged below $3 a million BTU. We have no pipelines in field. I mean, you can't transport natural gas without a pipeline, even from well to the separation plant. So we are lacking infield pipelines. We're lacking pipelines to gas plants. We're lacking pipelines to the markets, which would include the Gulf Coast and the mid-continent region and those people in the Northeast here in New England who evidently prefer to freeze in the dark, and also to Gulf Coast harbors, which is really the key to our natural gas glut right now, and that's LNG.
Yeah, well, I think we'll see some innovations and some way somebody will figure out how to get that gas where it needs to be, because they're not too keen on having the companies flare it. And you know what a flaring is when by a well.
I mean, it's nearly criminal, or it's from a capitalistic point of view, how much gas we waste. But what are you going to do with it except flare it? It's not economic. In fact, in the Permian Basin right now, your gas, you got to pay people to take your gas. They're paying, instead of getting $2.40 for a million BTU, they're paying more than that to have people take it off their hands. The only thing we can do is build new pipelines. And in the Permian, we're 1 to 2 years away.
Right.
We're constrained with oil production there now, too, because of not enough pipeline capacity. But the real key, once again, is if we can get it to Gulf Coast and get these LNG facilities, port facilities, export facilities, floating LNG processors, et cetera. We can get more of those, then we can export a lot of gas to the rest of the world. Requires big CapEx.
Yeah.
There's been some booms and busts. Banks now require hard contracts before they'll finance these things. But we've got more infrastructure coming in the Gulf Coast right now. 4 new plants scheduled for 2019. 2, which are being financed with initial production from 2022 to 2024.
Wow.
And another 7 awaiting Fed approval with the same sort of timeline. Here, while we're on LNG, I'll give you a couple of numbers. In 2007, the U.S. was a net importer to the tune of almost 22 billion cubic meters of gas per year. In 2018, we are a net exporter to the tune of 28.5 billion cubic meters. So it's coming, but it probably can't come soon enough.
And, you know, we always talk about the arbitrage between WTI and Brent, but the arbitrage between U.S. gas prices and gas prices in Europe and Asia, $10, $15, as opposed to $2.40, is even more significant, but even harder to have any way to take advantage of it.
Well, if we can get it, on ships, we've got ready markets because they want our gas and they can get our gas much cheaper. It all comes with your return on your investment. So if they're paying the Russians $12 or $15 per million BTUs and our people can make money selling it at 8 or 10, well, you know what's going to happen there.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So and that arbitrage will narrow just like it has between WTI and Brent. And, you know, I just going back, like what is used as waste in the infancy of the oil production boom in the U.S., they were refining it. You know, they figured out how to refine it. All they wanted was kerosene to burn lamps. And the gasoline, I remember my father telling me, because in New Jersey, it was big refinery capital, they were dumping gasoline in the bay because they had nothing to do with it because it was before the advent of the internal combustion engine. They almost needed cars to get rid of that gasoline, which was worthless to them. So just interesting the way that the industry evolves. And now we're burning off gas, which has value, but because it's not readily or economically feasible to get it to market, it winds up being waste, you know, just going up into the atmosphere effectively or being burned off. And so there's got to be people now, Mickey, working on this situation and finding solutions.
Well, they are, and there's incremental solutions, but we're going to be saddled with this for a while for sure.
Yep. Yeah, and all over the world, they're flaring off natural gas. It's just in the wrong place. Saudi Arabia, every major oil field in the world, just about they're flaring gas off because they just can't do anything with it. That is kind of a shame when you think about it because it's valuable. You know, it really has a value, but it's in the wrong place at the wrong time. So therefore, it goes up the tail, out the exhaust pipe. And what can you do about it? So looking ahead, I saw an estimate from a guy who had predicted that the U.S. would be producing 12 million barrels plus a day in 2019. He said in 2023 or 24, he's expecting 17 plus million barrels per day of U.S. production.
Well, let's do the math. What is that? 5 years?
Yeah.
And so if we look at the increase in production over the last 10 years, we've gone from 5 to 12. And over the last year, we increased 1.2 million barrels per day. So that's feasible. The average yearly increase in demand worldwide is somewhere around 1.2, 1.3 million barrels per day. Now, that assumes a strong world economy. So it's feasible. Certainly, we can produce oil and gas as cheaply or cheaper than anywhere else in the world. The Saudis need high oil prices to meet their balance of payment and their social obligations to keep the people from rebelling from the kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Akshish.
The Russians are basically a one-trick pony. So all Putin has is oil exports, so they need high prices. I mean, he's got some nickel and some platinum, palladium. He's got uranium. But sanctions have certainly hurt Russia, especially their aluminum industry. So high prices are required to meet that. But certainly, if you do the math, there is enough increase in world demand that we can continue to supply that world increase in demand.
Yeah, for sure. And it's looking up. I think that should help hopefully keep a level on prices. I remember, Mickey, when world production was at 85 million, they said it can't go any higher. We're at peak oil. And now look, you know, we're probably upwards of 100 million and it's still going up. And it's being used, right? So we should.
Well, yeah. So we did pass 100 million barrels per day in demand last year. But we should also keep in mind that that includes, that 100 million includes natural gas liquids and condensate. So it's total petroleum liquids. If you take things classified strictly as oil wells, we're still in the somewhere between the range of 80 and 85 million barrels a day.
And so now would be a good time just to explain between the difference between dry and wet gas, because it's important to your understanding of how these markets function and what products are used and how things work.
Yeah, so dry gas is mainly methane. And some wells produce only dry gas, only methane. Significant other gas wells and even oil wells, it's a continuum, produce what's called natural gas liquids. Those would be the higher level hydrocarbons, such as ethane and propane and butane. People will know those names. And also what's called condensates, and condensates, as the gas goes into the pipelines, there will be liquids condensate out, and those are recovered. And people, you can probably not in a modern day car, but people used to, they called it drip gas. And in oil fields, for instance, in East Texas, where I worked when I was in my youth as a rouseabout, people would use drip gas to fire up their old vehicles. Yeah. You could burn drip gas in, and you could also tap in the pipeline and have your gas stove and convert it. You got to do a little conversion.
It'd be a little dangerous. a little dangerous if it's not done properly.
Heat your kettle in the morning.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a whole bunch of different things, like propane is a natural gas liquid. Right? Compressed natural gas.
Yeah. It's classified as NGL.
Yeah.
Dry gas is essentially not exactly 100% methane, but pretty close.
Yeah. So we got, and then they have different names for it too. You know, if you're not up on it, there's a whole bunch of different things. They call it natural gasoline, and the refineries love it because they can just mix it in with regular gasoline produced up the octane and lower its emissions properties. And they call it casehead gasoline. There's a whole bunch of different names for it, but it's a huge market and it's getting bigger, and it's become a very important aspect segment of the overall petroleum market, even though it's not strictly speaking oil from the barrel, from the well.
Correct.
So, hey, we would be remiss here if we didn't talk at least a little bit about electric vehicles, because there seems to be this widespread belief that electric is going to supplant internal combustion engines. And, you know, then what are we going to do? Because we don't need all this gas. Most of the gasoline, most of the petroleum produced goes for transportation fuels. So what's your take on EVs here?
Well, I'm not a proponent of the so-called EV revolution or the Green New Deal or whatever this all involves. Certainly electric vehicles are going to make inroads, but oil production, oil demand continues to increase, and we haven't seen any slowdown in that. We've also, you know, we've got, it's not all about gasoline. We have other fuels. And that's one of the caveats that you have with shale oil. They're light, sweet crudes, and we need heavy sour crudes for things such as aviation fuel, bunker fuel for ships, diesel, which powers a lot of things all the way from the tractors in my at my farm here to most big rigs rolling down the highway, kerosene. So that requires heavy sour crudes, other materials, asphalt, lubes, motor oil, petroleum coke. Mm-hmm. The plastics industry continues to grow exponentially. That requires light sweet crude. So there's lots of other things that that use petroleum oil products other than the gasoline that you put into your internal combustion engine. So certainly EVs are coming. I think they're coming more in China and Europe than we'll ever see in my lifetime in the U.S. You know, we still like our big F-250s and our Cadillac Escalades and our Lincoln Navigators, and even more so now. I mean, most American car companies no longer produce sedans. They're producing all big pickup trucks and SUVs. So from that point of view, I don't see a decrease in demand, no matter what the greenies are proposing to be carbon free by 2040 or 2050. As soon as those dim governors and legislatures get voted out, then we'll get practical people in who know that the world runs on oil and will continue to run on oil.
Yeah, my sentiment's exactly. 80 plus million cars sold last year, and EVs, like, production went way, way up. Only 2 million pure electric vehicles worldwide, and most of them in China. And it probably makes sense in China, although their pollution problems are not due to modern cars, which put out very little pollution. I mean, you remember the old movies where somebody would put a hose to the tailpipe and put it in the car and they'd be gone in 15 minutes. It would take you like a day to kill yourself that way now.
No, I'm not sure if that's true, Gary.
Well, but it's way, it's.
I think you can still kill yourself in a garage.
It takes time. It takes a lot more time and devotion.
Okay.
To it. That's
point
what I'm
well
saying. Because the emissions, tailpipe emissions, are down 95%+ since the 60s, which, you know, you get behind. I got behind a car today, actually. It was at the coffee shop. And the car was from the 70s, and the stench that thing put out, Mickey, I couldn't believe it.
Well, that's just because he's some low life who doesn't keep it tuned up, Gary.
Yeah, well, but
you
still.
You know, I got old cars, and you can't smell or see the smoke coming out of those. So
actually, it was because it was a Mazda Wankel powered engine, so that was always the problem with them, the pollution, but it smelled up the entire place. But you get behind a car from the 60s and you could choke on that exhaust. And it's not like that anymore with the advent of the catalytic converter and all the other things that they've done to reduce tailpipe emissions. So I kind of think that they're barking up the wrong tree here. Cars, it's still more efficient to power them with gasoline when they can get 500 to 1,000 miles on a set of batteries, then I'll start to be a believer, and they will get there. But even then, the batteries are so
that's
heavy.
That's a tough nut to crack, Gary, because the weight of those batteries.
I know, that's what I was
that's
saying.
That's the problem with EVs, the weight of the batteries at some point. I mean, right now it's about 200 kilometers, which would be, 120 miles. But
you can get them up to three, theoretically, on certain Teslas. But the extended range Teslas, but still, you know, if you want to go on a trip, say you wanted to drive from New Mexico to St. Louis to watch the World Series, all right, and you had a Tesla, you know, it's I guess it's about 1,000 miles.
You'd have to stop every hour and a half or
so. Yeah, exactly, for a half hour.
And charge the damn thing.
Correct.
Whereas I drove the Hot Rod Lincoln. From Albuquerque to St. Louis, I filled up in Albuquerque when I started. I stopped for gas twice, and I still had gas in the tank when I made it to St. Louis.
Yeah. So, you know, and you would have to stop three times with the EV or four, and you'd be stuck.
Oh, no, it's 1,100 miles, Kerry.
It's 1,100. So
you would have to stop 10 times.
Yeah, well, if you got 300. You theoretically got 300 miles, which would give you about 250. So you got to stop 5 to 6 times. And it's just not practical for that. But then again,
wait while the damn thing charges.
That's it. Wait 45 minutes for a charge.
It's not a 5-minute fill up in gasoline like I do with a Lincoln.
Yeah, you have to have activities planned for the kids when you're doing these stopovers, because they're going to be saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Yeah, no, we got to stop and charge the Tesla, and it'd drive you mad. But really, so that's what we're up against. But there are certain applications, like if GM had marketed the Chevy Volt properly, that could have been a great just scoot around.
I don't know, Gary. I don't really buy it. That could have been a friggin' disaster. So,
because it was a Chevy and not a Buick or a Cadillac. Made it a Cadillac.
So one last point I kind of want to make here is that let's talk about some of the problems that we have with the shale oil revolution and some solutions to that. So it's not all rosy in the shale oil patch. We've already mentioned the environmentalists and the shale bands in 3.5 states and selected counties. We got the so-called Green New Deal with the One World Socialists in the Congress, and the Democrats seem to be marching lockstep with these people. The idea of contaminating aquifers is ludicrous. Yeah. The examples they use are areas where people have opened the tap for 50 years and they've got contaminated, naturally contaminated water from
pure lies.
Oil or gas. But let's look at some of the real problems. And the water requirements are huge.
Yes.
And the industry is hard at work trying to figure out how to convert from using fresh water for fracking to salty water brines. They've made some inroads on that. They are now at the point where they're recycling processed water, cleaning it up and recycling it. You've also got production water, which comes out of any well. Most wells are going to produce a combination of water, which is heaviest, and oil, and then gas, which is lightest. So commonly an oil well is going to produce some, unless it's a free-flowing well like they still have in the East Texas oil field, you're going to have some dirty water. Historically, they have injected that into deep brine aquifers, but that's led to some problems we'll discuss here. So right now, the modus operandi, the new methodologies are to take this production water and decontaminate it to make it to gray water equivalents and use it to irrigate. So they're working on that, but water issues certainly from a supply demand vantage point are substantial. We mentioned about deep in high pressure injection. That certainly causes micro earthquakes, swarms of micro earthquakes. But generally less than 3.0 on the Richter scale. So you can't even feel those. But there was one specific problem in central Oklahoma in the mid-2010s with deep high-pressure injection along fault zones. They created some earthquakes up to 5.8. Now, that's a significant earthquake that can do damage in places that historically around Norman, Oklahoma, had never really had a history of earthquakes. So the oil and gas regulators in Oklahoma came in 2016, and they reduced permitted injection volumes and pressures and And over the last 3 years, a significant decrease in seismicity. We haven't seen any other earthquakes, I think, above maybe 4.5.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just agreeing that that the earthquake issue, seismic activity issue, definitely needed to be addressed. They were also injecting carbon dioxide into these things, which evidently wasn't a good idea. And I guess they've kind of figured that out.
Well, commonly carbon dioxide injection is used in tertiary recovery. And that use of carbon dioxide certainly is not going to go away. In northeastern New Mexico, there is a carbon dioxide reservoir that is exploited to use in West Texas to enhance oil recovery. That said, the big Achilles heel of shale industry is financial. And historically, get this, no surprise, it has been capital destructive. Estimates as high as 80% capital destructive. So it's left a lot of investors holding the bag with bankrupt companies, especially during the oil crash, which started in the fall of 2014, arguably went through November of 2016, with gas less than $50 a barrel for a significant amount of that time. Wow. So these EMPs, exploration production companies, the acronym EMPs, went bankrupt. They got taken over. They had to sell future production at pennies on the dollar. They lost their leases. We're now in a second wave. With better fundamentals, but capital is much more cautious. Netbacks, because of improved technology and efficiency, due to the oil price crash, lower costs, and probably the biggest thing is big oil moving in, especially in the Permian Basin. But I think we have to ask the question, is it sustainable? I mean, really, it's been a transfer of wealth from equity holders to landowners. And, you know, these companies, much like the junior mining sector, they raise dollars with equity. So, you know, land costs in the Permian have skyrocketed. Rig availability is problematic. There are now 8,800 DUCs in the U.S., a DUC is a drill but uncompleted well, and some of those are waiting for rig availability, but some of them basically are waiting for pipelines or prices to increase. So it's a boom and bust business. It historically has been that. You know, shale has pretty steep decline curves, although the Permian, we're getting some satisfaction that they may have longer well lives, certainly lots of wells now producing over a decade. We have to have confidence. We're going to have relatively high oil prices for the foreseeable future. And of course, we have to, based on precedent and history, evolving and improving technology to sustain the shale boom. I think it's going to happen. You know, my conclusion would be never bet against the oil business, because you can't count an oil man out. These guys are the most risk-seeking, reward-seeking entrepreneurs on the planet. Some of them are a bit crazy, but we need people like that to continue to make America great again.
Agreed there, Mickey. Couldn't have said it better myself. And with that, we'll wrap it up. Any questions, comments, just email me, kl@carrylutz.com. Check out Mickey's report. You can find it in the musing section on mercenarygeologist.com, published a few weeks back. And sign up for his newsletter and regular emails. Check us out, financialsurvivalnetwork.com, and sign up for our newsletter. And Twitter feed for Mickey is @mercenarygeo. Ours is @CarrieLutz. And watch the feed for the latest interview and the latest articles published. Mickey, we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It's been a lot of fun, Carrie.